Hi, I'm Katie Harris. I'm a senior associate in Boyes Turner's employment team. This employment podcast series is going to be looking at the different elements of corporate support work that we do as employment lawyers. In our last episode, we were joined by Chris Dobson, who's a partner in our corporate team. Chris looked at the different types of corporate acquisition and what a typical acquisition process looks like. In this episode, we're going to take a closer look at the employment aspects relating to these different types of acquisition and how the employment issues differ between them. I've been speaking with Natalie Wood, who's an associate solicitor in our employment team, and he works very closely with me on these acquisitions. To start, Natalie reminded us of the different types of acquisitions that Chris spoke about in the last episode.
So starting with a share purchase, simply put, that's where a buyer or buyers take over the ownership of a company by acquiring its shares from the company's existing shareholders. In this type of transaction, a buyer takes over everything, so the good, the bad, and the ugly, so all assets, obligations, and liabilities of the company that they're acquiring. So one way to think about it is that the company is a box of biscuits, and inside that box, there are different biscuits. Some are nice, others not so much. In a share sale, the buyer buys the box, including all the biscuits inside it, whether they like them or not.
I love that analogy, Natalie. And that makes it so clear. What about an asset purchase then?
An asset purchase, conversely, is where the assets of a company are acquired, so rather than the company itself. Such assets could include equipment, inventory, real estate, contracts. So in these types of transactions, purchasers can elect what assets they wish to purchase and which that they don't want to purchase. So assets that are not bought or sold under the terms of a transaction just simply remain with the seller.
Right. So thinking back to our box of biscuits analogy, which I think is fab, in an asset sale, the buyer doesn't buy the box. Instead, they select which biscuits out of the box they want to buy, and then they just leave the others and the box behind.
Exactly. So fairly different models of acquisitions, and you could see why the position of a business or a company may inform a buyer's decision as to whether they want to buy the company's shares or whether it just wants to buy a particular asset or biscuit or biscuits from the business instead. So from an employment perspective, I think, you know, obviously there are some differences between the two types of transactions. Sort of in your view, what do you think these are?
Yeah, so you know, I think the box of biscuits analogy is really helpful, actually. So, yeah, the key difference is that under a share sale, as you've just beautifully described, the buyer is acquiring the entire company, so including all of the employees sitting within that company. But that also means that it's acquiring all the rights, liabilities, and obligations associated with those employees. And this is the important bit, not just the employees that are currently in the business, but potentially all former employees and future employees. It's literally, as you say, buying everything relating to those employees, warts and all. But with an asset purchase, the position's quite different. And the main reason for that is because of a piece of legislation, which I think we briefly touched on it in the previous podcast. But this piece of legislation is called the Transfer of Undertakings Protection of Employment Regulations 2006, affectionately known as TUPIN. and in most cases, in most, not always, but in most asset purchases, TUPIN will apply. And this is quite a big difference between the two.
And so what would it mean if TUPIN were to apply?
So TUPIN is really complicated. Now, I think it's fair to say that it's not everyone's favourite piece of legislation.
No.
But essentially what TUPIN does when it does apply, which as I said will be in most asset purchases, its whole purpose is to protect the employment of any employees who are employed within the business or that part of the business that's being acquired by the buyer. And the primary way that it does this is by applying what we call an automatic transfer principle. And essentially what this does is that it automatically transfers the employment of any of those employees engaged in that business to the buyer. And that happens whether the buyer wants it. So the buyer might not want a whole bunch of employees, but, you know, if TUPIN applies, the buyer will be getting them. And equally, it doesn't matter necessarily if the employees don't want it. It happens but automatically and by operation of law. And of course, it's not just the employees that will transfer to the buyer. It will also be the majority, not all, but the majority of the rights, liabilities and obligations associated with them. In contrast to a share sale, however, and again, this is an important difference, the buyer is only going to be inheriting those rights, liabilities and obligations relating to the employees that are transferring. So, say for in limited circumstances, the buyer won't inherit any rights or liabilities relating to former employees, or indeed any employees who are remaining with the business. So often if it's just part of a business that's being acquired, you know, the other part of the business will stay where it is and all the employees working in that part of the business will stay put. And, you know, so it's just a small group of employees that are transferring to the buyer. So it will only be the rights and liabilities and obligations associated with those employees, not all employees, which is what we have in a share sale.
Got you.
The other thing that's really difficult about GP, and I think where we find most of the problems arising, is the restrictions that it imposes on what can and can't be done with those employees. So GP does this in two ways. The first thing it does is that any dismissals or termination of employment where the reason for those dismissals is because of or related to the transfer will be automatically unfair. And secondly, any changes to contractual terms, again, that are being made because of or for a reason related to the transfer will be void. So it makes it really, really difficult for either the seller or the buyer to terminate employment or change contractual terms where GP is involved. Now, there is an exception to this, and that's where, you know, the buyer or the seller, whoever it is that wants to make the dismissals or the changes, can show that they have an economic, technical or organisational reason, otherwise known as an ETO reason, for either making those dismissals or those changes. But that can often be quite difficult to do. Now, look, we're going to go on and talk about GP in more detail, including ETO reasons in a later podcast. So I won't go into that now. But the bottom line is GP can make things quite tricky on an asset purchase.
So what inform and consult obligations are there under GP then?
Yeah, so this is another complication of the wonderful GP that can also make things a bit trickier for buyers or both parties actually on an asset sale. So when GP applies, it also imposes an obligation to, in every case, provide information, so a set of statutory information to employee representatives or recognised trade unions, providing a certain amount of details about the transfer. But in many cases, it will also impose a duty to consult with those employee representatives or, you know, recognised trade union. And the obligation to consult will arise where either the seller or the buyer envisages taking any measures in relation to any of the employees who are affected by the transfer. Measures in this context is quite wide, so it can even mean just sort of small administrative changes, for instance, a change to payroll date. So this obligation to inform and consult is something that has to be taken into account, particularly when we're looking at the timings of the transaction. And often, I think, as you know, Chris may have touched on in our last podcast, timings can be quite important. And often there's a pressure to complete an acquisition by a certain deadline, you know, and so it's really important to identify early on, you know, right, GP applies here, and do we have to consult? And if so, how long is this realistically going to take so that can be built in?
So quite a lot for a buyer to think about then.
Indeed, there is.
Yeah. Yeah. So under a share sale then, which sounds simpler from a sort of very generic overview sort of perspective.
Yeah.
Is it right to say that nothing changes for employees?
More or less. Yeah. I think that's yeah, obviously with an asset sale, as we just touched on, there is a complete change for the employees because the identity of their employer is changing and there will be a lot of other changes associated with that. Whereas in a share sale, you know, obviously if we imagine that the employees are some of the biscuits, they're sitting within the same box. That box isn't changing, their employer isn't changing. So it really should, you know, probably, you know, the day after the acquisition, the employees aren't really going to notice any difference at all. Nothing will change. It's business as usual. I mean, the only slight caveat around that is often on a share sale, the new buyers will come in and they might want to take the business in a slightly different direction, or they might have a slightly different strategy. So over time, they may want to implement changes which can affect employees. And, you know, a bit of a warning point here, just because we're dealing with a share sale, you know, some people think, oh, it's great, cheapy doesn't apply. But then, you know, they forget to remember that often you'll have a share sale, and depending on the plans for the business, particularly if the buyer wants to later integrate the target company into their existing business, a cheapy transfer might potentially arise further down the line. So, you know, just because a share sale is much more straightforward on the face of it and business as usual, still important to bear in mind that there could potentially be changes there affecting the employees that may also have, you know, important legal aspects to consider. So Natalie, we've talked a lot about the sort of different impact from an employment perspective, you know, that the different types of acquisition has on the employees and the businesses. Yeah. What about the legal process though? I mean, does that change much depending on whether we're dealing with an asset sale or a share sale?
It does, yeah. So in terms of the DD process, the starting point, for example, will be that in a share purchase or even an asset purchase is caveat emptor, so buyer beware. In a share sale, the seller isn't under any obligation to actually disclose to the buyer defects or liabilities of the target company, and a buyer has to do its own investigation.
That's interesting, yeah.
And with share purchase transactions, DD is a comprehensive exercise and would typically cover everything from employees, pension to property, commercial contracts, arrangements and tax. And from an employment perspective, the inquiries need to cover both former and current employees.
They're quite extensive then for a
exactly,
share.
Exactly. So whereas under an asset sale, the seller is obliged under 2P to provide employee liability information, which you touched on earlier, and they need to do that 28 days before completion at a minimum. And this basically is a set of information that about the employees who will transfer under 2P. So it will include things like their name, their age, their job title, if they've got any claims or grievances against the company. And in most cases, this information won't necessarily be sufficient for due diligence purposes, and wider inquiries will still need to be made. These inquiries can, however, be more limited than in a share sale. So a buyer will only be concerned really with the things it's buying. You know, there might be 100 biscuits in the box, but if they're only buying two biscuits, they'll only want to do DD in relation to those two biscuits. And a buyer, for example, probably won't be concerned with former employees because they won't be transferring. So the primary purpose in DD exercises is to identify areas of risk and to provide a buyer with an overview of the employment costs and general workforce makeup. But in summary, the key differences are that in a share sale, the buyer is inheriting everything. And so the DD process, Katie, as you sort of very correctly said, is more wide and broad ranging. Whereas in an asset sale, the DD can be more focused. And there can also be less certainty over which employees will be inherited by the buyer. So that generally in an asset purchase is one of the first tasks of the DD process, to identify which employees are assigned to the business immediately before the transfer.
And obviously that's quite an important thing to do. But, you know, how is it straightforward to do that? I mean, it sounds like it should be fairly straightforward, but I'm thinking, well, we know it's actually not that straightforward, is it?
Not at all, unfortunately, as sometimes employees who work in the part of the business being acquired are employed by another entity, such as a group company or third party. And sometimes they might work across different parts of the business, so it isn't clear if they are wholly assigned to the part that's transferring or not. A buyer will be keen to ensure that any key individuals they want to acquire will be transferring, and equally a seller will probably want to hang on to those people. But just because one party says an individual transfers and another says they don't, it doesn't necessarily mean that's the correct approach. As you mentioned earlier, obviously, 2P applies by operation of law, and an individual transfers by operation of law. Yeah. So it's sort of almost, in some respects, immaterial how you label somebody.
Mm. But, you know, in particular, writing for a buyer, it's really important part of the due diligence is to sort of really grapple with these different issues and, you know, undertake thorough inquiries so we know who's in scope.
Yeah.
You know, and that could be quite tricky, particularly when, you know, when we're dealing with employment status issues as well, because GP, you know, only applies to employees, perhaps workers, and I think the employment status definition is a bit broader than the normal under GP, but it doesn't apply to self-employed contractors.
Yeah, so determining whether an individual is an employee, worker or contractor can be a bit tricky. And it's not always enough that somebody is simply called a worker or an employee or indeed a contractor. You need to sort of look at what's actually happening on the ground. So what are their benefits? How do they work? What the level of control is there? All of this fun stuff. And where individuals are identified as contractors, buyers need to be mindful that they could in fact be employees or workers and therefore a risk that they could transfer under GP. So when dealing with asset sales, it isn't just about identifying individuals transferring. One of the other things to consider is to identify particular rights and liabilities that will transfer under GP.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So obviously in the due diligence process, and then the most important thing is to sort of, you know, identify potentially who's transferring or who might be in scope of transferring. But once we've kind of got a handle on that, you know, particularly when we're acting for a buyer, we're also going to be concerned about what rights and liabilities are transferring with those employees. Now, you know, I touched on it at the beginning. In most cases, you know, all rights and liabilities will transfer, but there are certain things that don't transfer, and it's trying to identify, you know, what our buyer is inheriting and what they won't be inheriting. So, for instance, we know under GP that contractual rights will transfer. So if an employee has a contractual right to a particular salary, for instance, that contractual right will transfer, which sounds straightforward. But actually, you know, sometimes there can be huge question marks over the extent to which something is a contractual right. So bonus schemes are a typical one. Is there a contractual right to a particular bonus? Is that right discretionary? If it is discretionary, what is the extent of that discretion? So these are all things that we need to look at and try and identify. Another particular issue that frequently arises is in relation to pensions, and the application of GP in relation to pension schemes is a really complex area of law. But as a sort of a high level overview, generally speaking, benefits relating to old age, survivors or invalidity under an occupational pension scheme won't transfer to the buyer under GP, but certain other rights and benefits under an occupational scheme might.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting, and it's a very difficult area, but it's obviously an area of, you know, potentially really high liability for the buyer, and so it's something that you need to be across really well as part of your due diligence process. Similarly, there are some rights that do transfer because they're contractual rights, but the buyer might not actually physically be able to provide them. So an example of that is rights and in the, you know, existing employer's share incentive scheme. You know, that's a contractual right that the employees have, so it will automatically transfer to the buyer under GP, but the buyer can't, you know,
they can't physically do it.
The buyer can't, you know, decide to allot shares in the old company to the employees. So that's a tricky one to navigate as well. And then finally, you know, a buyer will also want to sort of understand and compare the existing terms and conditions, rights and benefits with the employees it's inheriting with its existing workforce to see whether it needs to make any changes. And changes could range from simple change in payroll date, you know, so the existing workforce might be paid on the end of the month, the workforce that the buyer is inheriting might be paid mid-month, and, you know, that might be difficult to square off with payroll, so we might need to equalize those dates out. Could extend to more extensive changes such as to holiday allowance or pension provision. I mean, I think, you know, there's a common word that's used to describe those kind of changes, which is harmonization. The buyer will understandably want all of its employees to be on the same terms and conditions because that makes life easy for administrative and payroll reasons. So, you know, and it's really, really important to identify, or for the buyer to identify, whether these changes need to be made early on in the process. And that's because for the reasons we've already discussed, and that's largely the implication of GP, because first of all, we need to work out whether these changes or the buyer can make these changes legally. And secondly, because the buyer, you know, if it is going to make any changes, these will likely be measures, and the buyer will have an obligation to A, inform the seller under GP that they intend to take those measures, but also, you know, that will need to be the subject of consultation with the transferring employees, which needs to be built into the timeframe. So really important that we get, you know, really grapple with these issues and identify these things very early on in the DD process.
So it's sort of almost a looking at the current state of affairs and also with the forward thinking lens, really, sort of that's
absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and that's really important to know your client, because you need to not just, you know, you're not in a bubble just looking at this particular acquisition. You need to understand the future direction as well, and if you're acting for a buyer, what their intentions are and plans for that business, what's important to them, what isn't important to them, so that you can properly advise them.
So moving on to sort of a separate part of the transaction, but obviously all together, the SPA or the APA, obviously depending on the type of transaction. So in a share purchase, we'll have a share purchase agreement, and in an asset purchase, we'll have an asset purchase agreement. So as employment lawyers, we get involved with marking up warranties and indemnities or drafting new warranties and indemnities in these types of documents. So once we've gone through the DD process and we've identified the key areas of liability, how would we approach an APA versus an SPA, or, you know, vice versa, depending on the type of transaction that we have?
There are differences, again, which, you know, reflect the different nature of the transactions. Generally speaking, however, the goal is the same for both, particularly from the buyer's perspective. It's to manage and apportion risk that we've identified through the DD process. But in a share sale, it's traditionally only acceptable to include indemnities in a share purchase agreement where we've, you know, identified very specific liabilities and risks. And I think Chris talked about in the last podcast the importance of both sides being well advised and the importance of having, you know, early and sufficient information so that that advice can be commercial and pragmatic. Just because you've identified a risk there doesn't always mean that we're, you know, instantly going to fall onto an indemnity. It's about understanding that, you know, the nature, the level of the risk, and the relevance of that to your particular client will help you provide that advice of, you know, is this an indemnity that we really need, or can we take a more pragmatic approach here and perhaps deal with it in a different way through warranties?
Or, for example, a pre-completion obligation on the seller.
Exactly. Yeah, there are lots, you know, once we've identified a liability, there are lots of different ways potentially of dealing with it that don't always need to result in an indemnity. Obviously, everyone wants these acquisitions or transactions to go ahead and complete. And if we're throwing up barriers in the way and asking for indemnities unnecessarily, that's going to be problematic. So it is so important to be commercial about this, whilst obviously protecting your client. In contrast, under an asset purchase, it is much more common to have indemnities. And this is largely, again, because of GP. So GP, obviously, as we've already discussed, imposes certain obligations on the parties. And the interesting thing about GP is that, for instance, with information and consultation, each party, so the seller and the buyer, has an obligation to inform and consult with their own employees. However, the liability under GP is joint and several. So the buyer could potentially be liable for failings of the seller and vice versa. And so it is almost standard practice nowadays to have indemnities in the APA that kind of reverses and equalises the operation of GP. And what that might look like is the buyer will indemnify the seller for its failings under GP, and likewise the seller will indemnify the buyer for any failings caused by its fault under GP as well. So the starting point normally in an asset purchase is it's much more acceptable and common practice to have indemnities in there. But, you know, we will go on and talk in much more detail about the use of warranties and indemnities and from an employment perspective and typical ones that we come across and how they're used to apportion risk in one of our future podcasts.
So it's all really interesting stuff. And we've spent a lot of this podcast talking about Tupi and talking about sort of the differences in the share purchase and asset purchase. In our next podcast, we are going to delve deeper into the interesting area of Tupi. So namely what it is, I know we've touched on that today, but when it applies and how it will impact the employment aspects of an asset acquisition.
That was Natalie Wood, Associate Solicitor in the employment team at Boyes Turner. And as Natalie said, the next episode will be all about Tupi. So really helpful for anyone who's looking at dealing with asset purchases, because it's a very important part of the process to understand. Just subscribe or follow the podcast and you'll be able to listen to the episode as soon as it is available. Thank you and goodbye.